My immediate right, Joe Patridge, who is an independent recording engineer and producer based in New York City. And to his right, Dennis Rooney, a producer most recently best known for his work on the Columbia, on the Sony Columbia Masterworks Heritage Reissue Series.
Sony Classical?
No, Sony Columbia. Classical, excuse me.
Columbia.
Other members of our technical committee, and if you're here, when I acknowledge you, please stand up. Adrian Cosentini of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive. Gerald Gibson of the Library of Congress, who I believe is not here. Bill Klinger, an electrical engineer from Ohio, and one of our cylinder specialists. Is Bill here?
Yeah,
he just
Hi, Bill. And finally, Doug Pomeroy, another independent audio engineer based in Brooklyn, New York, in the back. Thank you. Well, I'm waiting for Seth to come back.
Testing.
Okay, we're here. Before we get into the main thrust of this presentation, Seth and I would like to say a few words about some of the future goals of the technical committee and some of the things we'd like to do down the road. We have a lot of expertise to draw on, both on the members of the committee and other people within the organization and even outside the organization. And it's the hope of Seth and I that we can bring a number of people into the organization to give presentations, write papers, and so forth. Seth and I have some immediate concerns of things that we're looking to for the next conference, areas we'd like to see covered. One thing that I am looking to do for the next conference is to bring someone in who has expertise in the area of transferring film to video at the correct playback speeds. Those of you who collect classical videos have probably been extremely frustrated by some of the sloppy work that's been done on film-to-video transfers. Some recent examples, Teldec's very famous Art of Conducting video, about half of those films have been transferred at half-step sharp. Deutsche Grammophon has put out two videos of Herbert von Karajan black-and-white films with the Berlin Philharmonic from the mid-1960s, some of Karajan's finest work. Both videos, the Beethoven Fifth, the Dvorak New World, the Schumann Fourth, rehearsal and performance, all a half step sharp.
The Europeans, they play at 25 frames.
And yet, some of those sharp videos that are on that Teldec video are on Japanese laser discs at the correct pitch. So something I'd like to do for the next conference is to invite a presenter with appropriate expertise to deal with that subject of transferring film to video at the correct playback speeds. At this point, I'll turn it over to Seth, and he can talk to you about some of his goals and priorities.
I haven't talked enough this afternoon already. Now I have to shift gears. Thank you. Well, since Gary and I have been made co-chair of this technical committee, I have a number of goals. I'm thinking of upcoming presentations, hopefully for next year. I'm going to talk to Sonic Solutions through Joe Patridge, who is, I would consider one of the best operators of the Sonic Solution editor and no noise around, as well as talking to Cedar to come hopefully maybe for next year to give presentations of showing how each of these systems can be used in conjunction with each other. In other words, neither of them are be-all and end-alls. You rely on one thing to take care of one process, you use the other to take care of another process. In unison, that's how finished masters are created, as Dennis and I and Dawn Frank over at Sony had done concerning the 1903 Grand Opera, which took an immeasurable amount of time restoring a lot of those original shellac pressings to a point that they were releasable. We'd also like to work on upcoming presentations for future conventions, suggested standards regarding digital preservation because of the fact that analog tape is still hanging on. Gary will talk about that, about the fact that there are still a couple of companies making analog tape, but we surmise that within the next 5 years, you're not gonna find any. What are we gonna go to? I mean, it's wonderful we bought all these wonderful tape recorders to play things back. What are we gonna copy them to? And then also working with various outside committees, AES, NARIS, about talking about suggested preservation standards and well as setting up some sort of standardization of preservation of analog material, lacquers, tapes, God help me, even cassettes, where a lot of things have been recorded. I remember going up to Columbia University to their oral history department and walking into a room about twice the height of this with rafters filled with cassettes dating from the late 60s on, and as we all know, Joe and I know those are the absolute horrors that things could have been put on to try to resurrect things like that. Possibly, who knows, maybe we can set up a website for collectors and institutions to go into to look for, I got a lacquer, it's got mold damage on it, what's the treatment in trying to resurrect this to play it? What is the equipment I need? This is where we have to push forward to into the 21st century. What we're going to do now is we're going to do proposals concerning digital preservation in an orderly manner of what certain institutions are doing and what are some of the suggested items of how to do this, some sort of rudimentary digital preservation for an institution or for a collector. So what we'll do is we're going to first go to Gary. We'll talk about his experiences concerning that and what to do concerning using it, since that is the most accessible form of preservation available right now to most people who cannot afford to go buy a dash tape that runs, what, about $100 a reel, if you can find it? Digital.
Which you can't anymore,
you can't anymore anyway. Then Joe will talk about all the various formats and what he has come across and what he would suggest we should be going into. Dennis, I will then talk about preservation that has been done over at Rodgers and Hammerstein, the Library of Congress, what things the Library of Congress has been seeing concerning what things have to be preserved. And then Dennis will wrap it up with what is being done over at Sony Music and also the Museum of Television and Radio and from some other outside sources. So Gary, why don't you start the ball rolling?
Thanks. First, an update on analog tape. There's little question that not only is the future of audio digital, but the present of audio is digital. Nonetheless, analog tape is hanging on a little bit. 3M last year sometime got out of the analog tape business. They discontinued their production of Scotch analog tape completely. And the rumors around the industry was that the other analog tape manufacturers, mainly Ampex and BASF, would follow suit shortly. Well, I have some updated information on that, which indicates that that's not quite true. This past Monday, I made telephone calls to Ampex and BASF, and George LaForgia at Ampex told me that Ampex has no immediate plans to get out of the analog tape business, that they're going to continue making analog reel-to-reel tape for the foreseeable future. He did not say what the foreseeable future is, but I would assume probably 4 or 5 years. So, and he also noted that Studer is still making analog reel-to-reel tape recorders, and I might add that Atari is also doing the same. So, Ampex will be making reel-to-reel tape for a while. At some point down the road, though, I think anyone still using analog reel-to-reel tape will have to make alternate plans, digital plans. But there is some time left if you're still archiving things on analog tape. Ampex also noted that they own all the basic patents to magnetic tape technology in this country, and that 3M was making all of their recording tape under license from Ampex as far as those patents were concerned. Ampex is right now in the process of gearing up to manufacture some of the 3M videotape formulations, and he said down the road they may very well pursue marketing some of Scotch's old audio tape formulations, analog audio tape formulations as well. So as far as Ampex is concerned, at least at this point in time, they will be making the old Ampex tape formulations for some time to come, and perhaps even some of the old Scotch 3M tape formulations. I also spoke to BASF on Monday, and as many of you probably know, a few years back, BASF acquired Agfa and began marketing the old Agfa analog tape formulations like the well-known PEM 468 under the BASF brand name. They have told me the same thing, that for the foreseeable future, they have no plans to discontinue the PEM 468 analog recording tape. Again, what the foreseeable future means, I'll leave to your interpretation, but maybe 4 or 5 years are out there yet. I would say as long as there are a couple of manufacturers making analog reel-to-reel tape recorders, there probably will be some analog tape there. But when it's all gone, everyone's going to have to make plans to go elsewhere, and obviously the most affordable means of doing digital recording is DAT, digital audio tape, which I've been using at the Crane School of Music at SUNY Potsdam for my live concert recording for about 6 or 7 years now. DAT is a very affordable recording system. There are really pretty decent DAT recorders available from the leading professional manufacturers, some of them for less than $2,000. DAT does have some limitations and some reliability concerns, however, and I'd like to touch upon those now. I have had dropout problems with DAT recordings. I have had defective batches of tape, and I have taken steps since I first started using DAT to guard against losing live concerts because of defective tape and dropouts and so forth and so on. We have to bear in mind that DAT is a rather fragile tape medium. The tape is extremely thin, it's very narrow. And what a DAT transport looks like, it looks like a miniature videotape transport where the tape is literally pulled out of the shell, wrapped around a rotating drum, and the drum spins and scans the tape diagonally and writes the information. Because the tape is so thin and so fragile, again, there are certain concerns there as far as the robustness of the DAT format. My approach to guard against losing live concerts recording with DAT is to run two DAT machines simultaneously with a digital link between them. In other words, I go analog into one machine and digital out of that machine to digital in the next machine. And I run two recordings simultaneously. And I use two different brands of tape. I use one brand of tape in the top machine and a different brand in the bottom machine. Because if you have a defective batch of tape and you're using tape from that same batch in both machines, then you're not covered. So that's kind of a belt and suspenders routine. In the archiving business, I realize that may not be as much of a concern, particularly if you're playing recordings that are not particularly rare and you're not worried about playing them several times. If you have a bad DAT tape, you can always go back and do it again. But if you're dealing with a situation where you're archiving very fragile recordings, maybe a rare cylinder that you don't dare play more than once, you might consider running two machines at once and having a backup. One of the other limitations of digital audio tape is clock jitter. If we have some time near the end of the presentation, I might get into that, but this is going to go quickly, so maybe we'll save that for later. If anybody would like to know a little bit more about jitter, I can talk about it after our other three panelists finish. So let's move on.
Joe?
I guess it was about 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, I was going to use this, actually.
Okay. Is this on?
Hello?
I guess it is. About 5 or 6 years ago, I was having a conversation with Morgan Cundiff, who was the curator of IPAM prior to my esteemed colleague Don Manildi, and we were talking about how much longer analog tape was going to last. And he thought it would be good for another generation, meaning that we could do one more pass of analog archiving and then we'd have to deal with the digital. Well, he turned out to be wrong. Digital is here now. And as Gary quite rightly pointed out, if analog tape is even available these days, it's very expensive and it's not the way to go. However, DAT may not be the way to go as well. There are a number of formats that are possible alternatives to DAT. Going back, of course, in the history of digital, going back to the SoundStream system, which was the first editor in which took up about a room about the size of this one. When I went to Salt Lake City in 1984 to see their facility out there, I was amazed at how much space was needed just to be able to do digital editing. Well, times have changed in a very short period of time, as you can see with Sadie. And as is true with the formats too, the stationary head formats are basically all dead. Dash, ProDig, all these things. The media is too expensive, the machines are not being supported, and although they may be more reliable over a long period of time, it's not a cost-effective alternative for anything but the largest and most wealthy archives. And even then, I don't know that there's much availability of media at this point. So I would say those formats are gone. Which leaves us with what's basically available today, which comprises the following formats: DAT, as Gary has spoken about, the Nagra-D, which I'll get to later, DTRS, which is the 8mm tape format. There's also a complementary format known as ADAT, but that's not really a professional format in the same way as DTRS, and is not as supported in the high-end professional and archival end. Exabyte, the CDR, removable drives like jazz drives, zip drives, and other sort of hard drive media. And magneto-optical, such as the Sony PCM9000 and the GenX GX2000 or GX8000. Well, all these formats have their... All these formats have their... what is happening at
the table here?
Thank you. All these formats have their advantages and disadvantages. As we spoke about with the DAT, it's currently the most popular format. It's currently the one that has the most support, both in terms of hardware and media. However, because of its very high signal density, it is very prone to dropouts. The reliability of inexpensive machines is somewhat suspect. The shelf life of that is totally unknown, although some manufacturers like Apogee claim 30 years. We won't know that for about another 20, at which point it may be too late. The format is only supports up to 16-bit at the present time, and that's becoming more of a concern in days when high resolution and high sample rate has to be considered as part of the archival picture. So also a breakage of the tape basically renders the entire tape useless. So there's a number of disadvantages to that, but currently it is probably, at least temporarily, the format that should be used until something better comes along. Now, as an alternative, one can go to the CDR. However, the CDR has its disadvantages. The error rates are very high. My experience in cutting CDR masters has been that there's about a 50% rejection rate by CD plants. If that is the case, I wouldn't want to have anything important on it as an archival format. Excuse me? Of course they are, but we're talking about using CDRs as archival material. Now, if CDRs have high error rates, then I wouldn't want to have important archival material on CDRs. We don't know anything about their longevity either. Then there's exabyte, which is a format that has to be used with a computer, which can be an advantage or a disadvantage depending on how you look at it. Again, we don't know about its long-term capability, but it is capable of high bit. It can go up to 24-bit. And the media is relatively inexpensive, and the hardware is getting relatively inexpensive as well right now. A format that might actually have a future in this is DTRS, the 8-channel format. It's very versatile in terms of 16-bit or higher storage. It also has the capability with the proper bit splitter to do high density, meaning 96K88.2, using a double AES format. With 16-bit, having 8 tracks, it gives you actually by far the most storage per unit cost, with the capability of over 7 hours of stereo 16-bit material on one tape. However, the downside is that the reliability is unknown, a dropout because of the cross-interleaving that is used in the writing of the material onto the tape will destroy all 8 tracks, not just 1 or 2. And it should be always done as a redundancy, which can be done with some of the bit splitters like the Prism MR2024. So that is a possible format for the future, especially because of its high bit and high sample rate versatility. The Nagra D is a digital reel-to-reel recorder that uses tape similar to what's used on Dash. It has the ability for high resolution, high sample rate. It's a very good, very well-built machine. Unfortunately, it costs $27,000, so it's not for most archives or most people, for that matter. I have heard of reports of dropouts, which is probably media-related. In the lower formats, sampling rate formats, 48K, 44.1, one can redundantly write to the other two tracks, and this format does not, a dropout mode would not necessarily destroy the other pair of tracks. So it's a good redundancy. You can take one machine out in the field and use it redundantly, unless you're doing 96K where it uses up all four tracks. But again, the media cost is, while not too high, is not the issue. The issue of the machine itself being extremely expensive. Magneto-optical, which is a growing format, probably the format of the future. Currently, the media is a little on the high side, and the machines have also not gotten into a realm where they're really affordable. They're still in the 10,000 plus range. But the format probably has a good future. It's fairly robust. And if the media drops down to somewhere near DAT prices, it could be the way to go. It is capable of up to 24-bit resolution. And finally, we have the removable hard drives like the zip drives, jazz drives, and things like that. Again, media cost is relatively high for this particular item, but this is probably another format that's growing and could be a good complementary format to DAT or to the DTRS format. It also has a capability for high sample rate. So that's what's out there. I mean, I would say that DAT is the way to go right now. CDR is a possibly good backup. I feel CDRs have to be checked afterwards, so that's an issue of time. I don't trust them to just write them and then put them on the shelf. There have been too many problems, at least in my experience. Dennis?
Are we going back?
Yes,
we're
going
to
come back.
We're going to you.
I'm going to talk about is a couple of procedures that are done at two of the major archives in this country. First is Rodgers and Hammerstein, which undoubtedly I've worked for. As of right now, we are still archiving on analog tape, either on Scotch 996 or whatever stock we have left. Oh, 908. Okay, sorry, 908. And ACRA 468. I'm involved with a project whereby we're borrowing material out of the Library of Congress from the NBC Central file collection for the Soria Studio of Met broadcast and of items for our Tuscany legacy. And my feeling was at the time, since we're not going to have access to this material, that it is going to be going back to LC, that I have a DAT machine to record the disc in a flat stereo and process mode onto DATs, and then from that play the DATs back and make a preservation tape with whatever equalization and editing I want to do, so that down the road, when we do decide that we're going to put in a digital workstation, I do have that material that we don't have access to anymore in a digital mode already, unprocessed, that then can be processed as through Cedar or Sonic or Sadie to do another reconstruction on this project. We do have a CDR machine, which we're essentially using for exhibits, if I'm correct, right, Adrian? We are not archiving anything on that. It's, in other words, we have the galleries where they play music and everything, and they make Adrian will make a recordable CD in whatever order is needed for the presentation. Of course, we're coming up against the wall, like what we were talking about, and we are going to be seriously, within the next few years, contemplating which direction we're going in. We may just have to go to DATs for the moment and go with some sort of simple digital editing system until funds are available or the powers that be allow us to go further in that direction. Now, I spoke to Jerry Gibson over at the Library of Congress concerning what they're doing, and they're running into some very interesting problems. They're doing what's called a three-phase audiovisual risk assessment of their motion picture film cans. Of all 750,000 they've got there that were completely assessed, and they said the condition's not good. They're seeing a very high rate of deterioration when they're opening things. Now they went into magnetic tape of stuff that's sitting there. They They assessed 25% of the total inventory of what's there in their holdings. Of that 25%, 25% of that showed the sticky shed problem that we're all coming up against. But they did say something about that. Notice this is the Ampex and Scotch from the stocks that were put out in 1976 to 82. But he did say something that the in-house tapes that Library of Congress made and stored there under their optimal conditions, which is 50 degrees Fahrenheit or lower with a 25 to 30% relative humidity, showed no sticky shed oxide problems. It was tapes that were made outside by private collectors for studios that were then, you know, sent over as acquisitions. So apparently, there's something there concerning the initial storage of these tapes that is causing a problem. That the initial storage, which wasn't done properly, is causing all this tape to break down. Storing it at 50 degrees, 25 to 30% relative humidity, they found has slowed down these tapes from breaking down to a point of that where you have to bake it. It's an interesting thing. Joe has a batch of Amtex 406 that we...
Seven. 407.
That
highly unrecommended.
That was purchased in 1990. Chuck Haddix talked about the Scotch tape that he was using recently for preservation where it's starting to shed. Well, we put on a couple of these reels and they were squealing like crazy. Now, this is supposedly 1990 stock, not 1982 stock, where they've corrected that lubrication problem. We're going to be up against the wall on a lot of this, and even baking the tapes have problems in the sense that it increases print-through problems, and then the tape will revert back to that sticky shed syndrome within 100 hours after baking, and then you may not be able to bake it again and get anything out of it, meaning you have within 100 hours to make a copy of it. They haven't done any evaluation of lacquers to see how things are deteriorating. I could show you lacquers at Rodgers and Hammerstein. In fact, I just did a dub for a Philharmonic box of the Bruckner 9th with Klemper and the New York Phil from 1934 that are still in relatively good shape. And I could show you lacquers from 1954 or 55 where it has absolutely dried and peeled right off the base. They did a survey of optical discs. It's an ongoing thing concerning commercial CDs and CD-ROMs they have, and they found that the failure rate on those is relatively low, only 5%. So they have a better rate with CDs and CDRs than they are with the analog tape they have in their holdings. So we are up against the wall on a lot of things, and we're trying to come up with something whereby, from what we're seeing now, an agreement is that is not the answer, but it is a stepping stone that, all right, maybe we have a door of about 4 or 5, maybe 10 years on a debt before it really dies, but at that point we'll have something of a little more permanence in the digital domain it can be copied to. That's the trick. And the beauty about, at least in digital copying, provided there isn't too much jitter, right, Gary? You can make a clone that is reasonable, that is a mirror image of what is there, as opposed to analog tape, that when every time you make a dub, you're adding in noise, which is inherent in the equipment and the media itself. Well, I want to turn it over to Dennis, who will now talk about what Sony is doing.
Well, as consultant, archives consultant, is this working? That is belt and suspenders. As an archives consultant to Sony Classical, the question of preservation at this point has been deferred to some extent until we have identified all of the assets and put them in proper order. However, as a general rule of thumb, because of the confusion and uncertainty surrounding what is the archival medium of choice, whether analog or digital, I have been advising that we simply conduct a program of inspection and evaluation, and only in the case of active deterioration or obvious imperilment of the master material should any kind of protection copies be made. However, at this point, there is no longer any thought of doing 30 IPS analog open reel tape. That era has definitely closed as far as Sony Music is concerned. The Sony Music archives are engaged in a very ambitious project of digital preservation, which will include not only audio but video and computer graphics as well. This is tied into the creation of Sony Music's global archive system, which is envisioned to serve Sony personnel worldwide by being able to pull up at your desktop terminal not only audio documents, but also a complete history of the release in terms of its editorial and graphic content, and all of the notes relating to the session. In other words, the kind of unified storage system concerning the assets of the company that people have dreamt of, and then now, no matter how long it may be until it is realized, if indeed it ever can be realized for something that is this large, at least it makes it theoretically possible. And they are embarked on an archival storage system. They've designed a system entitled EMAS. Don't ask me for an explanation. None was forthcoming when I talked to the system's designer, Malcolm Davidson, at the Sony Music Archives. He didn't care to become too specific about the EMAS system, and so I'm going to read verbatim what information he gave me. He described it as a system using Sony Betamax DTF cartridges, which are helically scanned. Now, the current capacity of such a cartridge is 42 gigabytes, but that size is expected to increase within 18 months to 84 gig, to 168 gig in 3 years and 400 gigabytes in 5 years. This system is a sequential access rather than a random access medium, and the theoretical capacity of it is a value that he didn't care to divulge, but merely said it was very large. It will support up to 24-bit and will accommodate whatever multi-track configurations are presented to it, and it can accommodate 88.2 or 96K. The only differing factor will be available storage space. And since we're talking about effectively infinite storage space, at least for practical purposes, that doesn't seem to be an important consideration with respect to this system. It, as I said, will not only store audio, but video and computer graphics. And at the present time, only audio and computer graphics are being loaded. The data will be available in a client server with open architecture that is user-friendly. That's his description. At the present time, what is being transferred to this system in the way of audio documents is not lacquer discs or old magnetic tape, but U-matics. Because of all of the various mastering media that have been used over the decades, the U-matic is turning out to be the most unstable and the most rapidly deteriorating. And as you know, the U-matic, of course, is audio on what was a video medium. It is not a fully recordable medium. It uses a control track, which can be easily nicked, and when nicked, collapses the envelope for that period of time. U-matics are still the standard of the recording industry. I mean, despite their weaknesses, despite the fact that everybody acknowledges that they're basically useless 6 months after they're made, that's what's still being made. The wheels, particularly when they involve the hardware division of Sony Corp, move very slowly at the Sony Music Studios. 20-bit masters are still made on open reel dash. And they probably have more dash machines than I've ever seen in my life within the confines of those walls. And a 48-track half-inch dash reel is something you don't want to have dropped on your toe accidentally. But it's like working with buggy whips, truly. I mean, it's as heavy as a beeswax master and not nearly as stable. So is fairly likely. I mean, I know in my own projects that just in doing the budget for the studio work, the cost of the dash media is so high that I have now decided that I'm going to archive my projects strictly on either exabyte or on PCM 800 8mm cartridges, because both will support 20-bit and both seem to be far more stable, and the media is incredibly cheaper than dash, but it's amazingly still being used, and even being used on the road. So they tend to be using PCM 800s more and more, and the 9000 for frontline location recordings. But those 48-track dash machines are still packed up and shipped out and back again. It's kind of like two Scully lathes in the field up until 1950. And that's how long it took Columbia to change over to magnetic tape full time. In any event, this audio, which is currently being loaded through the Sonic Solutions editors as sound files, is being transferred from the hard drives, which are physically transported at the present time from Sony Music Studios to the EMAS storage silo, which is located over at the corporate headquarters at 550 Madison Avenue. Now, I've known that just anecdotally for quite some time, but when I mentioned it to Malcolm, he seemed extremely uncomfortable in confirming what I already knew. In fact, he seemed absolutely obsessed with security and confidentiality to the point of not wanting to talk about anything in detail. In this particular case, it was as if he imagined a possible hijacking of Bruce Springsteen masters by masked men somewhere between 54th Street and 10th Avenue and 55th Street and Madison Avenue. Anyway, he said that whatever changes in digital audio technology would evolve, that this system would be well prepared for them. And of course, the one obvious question he was at pains to answer very specifically: why are they using a tape medium on a system that is supposedly going to be running for decades to come and is costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop? And his explanation was this: data is encoded in this system using Reed-Solomon coding when transferred, and when read back, the raw error rate on the medium is read prior to any error correction, enabling statistics to be built up of the medium's quality, which allows replacement to be made in the event of perceived physical degradation, and that replacement will preserve all data before any danger of any loss takes place. The other advantage is that the process is performed robotically, that the whole system operates robotically. And at this explanation, I had visions while he was telling me this of something out of the Forbidden Planet, where Krell systems, perpetually maintained, continue to operate ceaselessly thousands of years after their designers had perished. If one of his own robots operates similarly, said Davidson, I'll be with them in spirit. Things were a lot simpler at the Museum of TV and Radio. I spoke with Martin Yaskowitz of their technical department, and they currently use two archival digital formats, DAT for audio and D2 for video. And they were chosen for one reason above all else: affordability. All of their transfer work is performed in New York. There is one transfer engineer who works steadily on audio on a regular basis. Video is done on a project-by-project basis using available video engineering personnel. The curators make the decision as to what will be archived, but there isn't any systematic archiving at this time, as far as I was able to determine. The museum has a core repertoire of about 500 programs which are available to the public, both radio and television programs, at its New York City and LA facilities. The LA uses CDR. New York uses an old Sony Hi8 PCM digital system which is stored on VLCS 800 carousels. And if you want something that's not in this core repertoire, you have to apply for it, and it's made on a one-off basis, and then you're allowed to look at it. But since none of their inventory leaves the premises, they're not concerned with making copies for the public at all. Those are the two archival systems that I was able to discuss at some length with their designers or caretakers. And Joe has already mentioned some of the strengths or weaknesses in the various digital media as far as their archival suitability. I have used DAT for about 7 years now and I have encountered one faulty cartridge in that time. This is not scientific, this is merely anecdotal. Sony PDP DAT stock, which is exclusively used at Sony Music Studios, seems to have a little or no failure rate as far as any anecdotal evidence comes, just in terms of things that have had to be redone that I'm aware of. We also make extensive use of exabytes and have for the last 5 years as the way to store finished projects that are edited on the Sonic Solutions editor. And although Seth just had a drastic failure with his own exabyte last week, the biggest problem with them seems to be that their machines, rather than the media, tend to fail fairly regularly. I've had a lot of exabytes that couldn't be made because the machine wasn't working, I was told, or the machine quit last night or something. Exabytes are one of those things that are usually done between 10:30 in the evening and 8 o'clock in the morning. So once made, however, they seem to be quite stable and can be recalled and restored, as they say, without incident. And they, excuse me, have certainly been the principal way to archive work done on the Sonic. With the cost of hard drives and memory in general continuing to drop, it's hard to know exactly where the hard drive is going to go in terms of its, you know, being a stable and recoverable system. I want to finish my part of this presentation by simply sharing with you some of the observations of a close friend of mine who I feel has more than a little expertise in this field. William Lund worked with Dell Eilers. They were the two senior technical service engineers for the 3M Magnetic Products Division, which of course has now been shut down. And Bill tells me that 3M expected another 5 years of good profits when they decided to shut down. They had just recognized that the end was near and they decided they'd rather get out sooner or later. He continues to feel that the 30 IPS half-inch analog format is unsurpassed for master recording, but that it's simply not cost-effective as an archival medium and certainly does not offer any technological superiority to any of the various digital media as an archival medium for that reason. Whereas Joe suggested DAT with CDR as a backup, Bill seems to turn the coin the other way. He is very enthusiastic about CDR, with DAT continuing to play a role, certainly as an ancillary or possibly a protection medium. The reasons for this are simply that, in terms of the aging tests that have been performed at 3M and elsewhere that he is aware of, that they have suggested somewhere in the nature of 100 years. I mean, all of this is, as we all know, rank speculation. As he said, we expected 224 to last for years, and it crapped out within five. And that's the whole history of the analog tape formulation in the last 20 years, is that the length of life is completely unpredictable. But then we also have to remember what tape was in 1950. No one had any idea how long it was going to last. No one ever could have imagined that the acetate lacquer disc, which was envisioned as a time shifting medium with short-term use as its primary goal, was going to be stable enough to hold audio in as perfect in a state as I can imagine over the course of 65 years, as well as it's done with the relatively little amount of deterioration that it's shown. So all of this is not to suggest that I think anyone has any special insights into how long any one of these media will last, but simply that sooner or later you have to just decide that if your holdings include material that's in danger of being lost, then you're going to have to choose something that you're going to transfer it to. If it's not, then I continue to prefer desuetude as the ideal archival strategy, and combined with a program of regular inspection and careful reporting. If you don't need to copy it, then for heaven's sakes, don't copy it. But if you need to copy it, and particularly if you need to copy it in order to make it available to scholars and or the general public, whatever the ground rules of your institution are, then you need to choose something that is as trouble-free and effective as possible. And given the fact that a current 63-minute CDR sells for as little as $5.50 each, which is now cheaper than a DAT, and that standalone players are available for around $2,000, which is about equal to the cost of a modified or upscale DAT player, or that if you have a computer-based editing system such as Sonic or Sadie, that you can use an add-on unit which goes through the SCSI port of your computer, which can now be purchased for about $500, that's a relatively small financial investment to get into a fully digital preservation medium. Bill is someone who tends to be on the skeptical and cautious side, and he's unreservedly enthusiastic about CDR. And the only reason that I'm conveying his thoughts is because of that unreserved enthusiasm. This is a man who's been involved in archiving both from his own private side as a collector and a custodian of historical radio broadcasts, his work in the broadcasting industry, and his work in the 3M Digital Products division. I want to convey this enthusiasm to you. As he says, the 44.1 kilohertz compact disc is a worldwide standard with abundant hardware in existence everywhere and a proven record of stability and reliability and simplicity of operation. No technological evolution will challenge the ubiquity of the CD for the near future, and even if within one or two decades a new standard is adopted, any information on CDRs will be readily transferred to that standard. Now, DAT, he feels, is simply that much less reliable. So we have here a slight conflict of views, which simply means that no one really knows for sure. But it's quite clear that for the institution with a limited budget, you're not going to be able to afford, nor would you want to get into anything as elaborate as the Sony EMAS system, using these enormous sequential access cartridges. Now, the only reason for this that makes the sequential access even viable is the fact that these can be made to operate at very high speeds. The data, for instance, is transferred at something like 10 times real time when it is transferred from the hard drives that are transported by this group of couriers from the west side to the east side. And it's then downloaded at night into the EMAS system. But this kind of system represents something that is utterly unrealistic for anything but the largest corporations. And then they have to be corporations that can, to some extent, indulge in hardware fantasies and have the pockets deep enough to back it up. And that's really about where it is, except for one thing I wanted to share with you that Bill said, unrehearsed and unbidden by me. We're talking about the end of analog tape. And he said that even, you know, those institutions that had stocks of analog tape left should probably use them with confidence, as long as they knew that they weren't running into binder hydrolysis. But to invest in any more at this point, he felt, was not cost effective. Also, he continued to state that the professional tape medium is the only way to consider storing anything, that analog cassettes are, and I'm quoting him, of no value as a medium for storage of anything. Not only is the time-based stability bad, but also the inevitable intermodulation distortion resulting from the combination of low linear speed and the equalization required to compensate for it, and the low density coating weight of the magnetic material on the tape, which becomes particularly problematical at low frequencies. So, frankly, right now, given our experience at Sony with regard to the deterioration of U-matics, those archives who are holding a lot of material on analog cassette, for whatever reasons, might want to think very seriously now about a digital storage medium which can be started up for relatively low cost to be used to comprehensively start to play those cassettes back and get them protected as fast as possible. I think that's the summary of my report.
Okay, we'll take questions now, if anybody has any.
Yes, I'd like to share with you the experiences that I've had as a librarian, as the chairman of the AAA. And I've had a number of people ask me about what kinds of things should they be doing for their projects in preservation. And you kind of alluded to this, but you haven't really done it. You've really said it. And what I always tell people is redundancy is the most important thing. If you have to do a preservation project, if you don't have to read, you know, you should really evaluate your materials first to make sure that it's stuff that has to be re-reported. And if so, then it needs to be, you need to come up with something. And then what we recommend is redundancy. One, analog, always analog tape, because at this point, it still is the most stable medium that we know about. These other things may be stable as well, but we don't know that yet. Dat tape, well, if you do that, you recorded that, and your idea about redundancy in dat is a very good one. But then you put the tapes away and you don't touch them, because if you play them, you're going to subject them to the abuse that makes them deteriorate. So you have to make sure you put them away. If you need a listening master, then you make a separate one, something that's
that's correct. The service, just service copy. For that.
Other medium, well, you know, it's all a crapshoot. CDR maybe, who knows? But the idea is that, you know, we try to use the most conservative methods that we know at this point. And putting stuff into a digital media is a very good idea, because later on we can change it, but only very limited materials.
Well, I have in my own experience, I know that I could not, in truth, argue that analog tape is a stable medium, not as it is manufactured today. I can play back analog tapes, and remember that I'm talking here about analog tapes of master generation material that were recorded 40 years ago. I can play back lacquer discs that were recorded 65 years ago and encounter greater stability than I can within tapes that were used to make master recordings within the last 10 years. The idea that analog tape is inherently more stable than digital media at this point, I believe, with all due respect to people who hold the contrary opinion, is an outmoded concept and should be reevaluated immediately. If we need to make backups, then let us choose two different digital formats, because we have the ability to slave them together without having to go to analog at any point, provided you have a robust enough word clock. And have CDR and DAT. If you want to put a DAT away, fine. The thing about CDR is you can play them over and over again with no danger of deteriorating the medium, whereas the DAT, even as stable as it has proved to be, is encased within a plastic enclosure, mass manufactured, which is hardly made to tolerances that suggest that if you leave it untouched for 10 or 20 years, assuming that you had to, and I doubt very much if you would, because it probably will erase itself before that period of time, there's always the chance you're going to have the moving mechanism jam on you, not to mention the risk that one runs in any longitudinal medium. That's another reason to prefer any kind of optical medium at this stage. But you're quite right. We can't put all of the eggs in any one of these.
Quantity of analog tape, thinking that, well, Ampex may discontinue 456 next year. I want to have 5 years worth of it so I can keep reporting on analog tape. It's a good possibility that 5 years from now you pull a brand new tape off the shelf and try to record on it. You may not be able to record on it. So I think the stockpiling thing to protect yourself against tape being discontinued is not a good idea.
The real problem is, as you just pointed out, that there really is no very good archival medium to record upon. If you put things into a digital format, that's great, but the physical form of the media is just as bad as an analog tape. At this point we're in a real problem, and that is, what are we going to record on? And it's only in dire dire circumstances, I think that anybody should really consider doing a preservation recording project. And then the only thing to do, if you have to do it, is to be as redundant as possible.
I want to pick up on that and say once again how important that concept is to get across to people. If you don't need to protect it, then for God's sake, let it be. Just look at it and make sure you're not seeing any signs of obvious deterioration. Because we have hundreds, thousands of Dolby A encoded multi-track safeties that were made of our edited master tapes in the belief that that would back them up. And they were made 15, sometimes 20 years ago. Not one of them has proved to be in better condition than the appropriate, you know, the surviving original edited master. The edited masters have held up better, in fact, and the Dolby copies are all worthless shelf wasters. And this was a program that was they went to 24 track Sony Dash to back up the multi-track masters. And that's all garbage now. I mean, the error rates in that tape make it absolutely useless most of the time. I've had Dash Masters fail magnetically within 5 days of completion. And, you know, requiring, it wasn't just a question of, we had to go back and regenerate the entire project from the elements because that was our only master, and that had, you know, this supposedly stable to the max, a wonderful digital medium, Open Reel, had just decided to go west. And any one of them can, which is why obviously redundancy is absolutely necessary. But if any of them can, then all of them might. So it's just a question of what can you afford and what looks like maybe it's the best pony to bet on, if you don't mind the vernacular.
Steve? I'm in full support right now of the recordable compact disc, but of those which use the gold dye and the gold sputtering with the extra layer of resin protection over the lacquer only. There has been test work done on these, done by the manufacturers, which does make it a little questionable, but at least they do it while the material is on its way to or on the market, rather than 10 years, publishing a report 10 years after it's already established and about to go off the market, which is what has happened in the past when we've had independent testing done. And those tests really, both the one from Kodak and one from Mitsui, really do support the 100 to 125 year anticipated life, which is basically reduced from the 300 plus years that they actually extrapolate using the math by which these are normally computed for not just tape but for all products within the testing industry, those outside of audio as well.
As opposed to the 3.6 years that the AES posits for a compact disc's lifespan.
Well, that's for a commercial compact disc, not for one which uses the dye, which I believe is far more stable, and which these tests, I think, do indicate. And I've been over the tests. I'm not just reading from the front page or from the conclusions. The one that Mitsui distributes through Apogee, for whom they make the disc, actually has some typos in it, and we really have to correct it from the charts and work backwards to really see what they're saying. But once that's done, it really does support this kind of anticipated lifespan testing for what they're testing for, not necessarily for putting it in an atmosphere where people smoke and so forth, all the other variables. But I think that it looks to be from the two tests and the confirming report from Bill Nugent at the Library of Congress about the Kodak test, that it looks to be quite stable. Seth's comment about the baking of tapes, temperature while it is actually being baked. And that, I think, the top end of that, when you do swing up, causes increased molecular velocity, and the print through may be coming from that. So I've had no difficulty at all. I've gotten a lot of kudos from people who thought they never knew they'd pitch.
Well, I'd like to second that by simply saying that at Sony Music Studios, where tapes from quarter inch to 2 inch are being baked every day in our two Farberware convection ovens, that contrary to what has been said in other places, tapes have been, whether accidentally or deliberately, baked more than once without any obvious deterioration of the tape, and that once desiccated, the tape plays back without incident. There is more oxide shedding with back-coated tapes made after 1975. It seems to come with the territory. And frankly, let's just admit that it's a metaphor for the effability of human endeavor. You know, I mean, if it's going to shed, it's going to shed. There were those people who used to think that the double-backed 3M tape of about 25 years ago was supposed to offer significantly longer life, and there doesn't seem to be any support for that now, 25 years after the fact.
Okay, let's give the new committee a round.